The idea is you get out of North Ministry, you start your journey, you become a journeyman.
That's the idea.
Okay, let's stay high level, okay? You're getting into too much detail. What changed? Why are you back?
He just kept begging me to come back and like, dude, all right.
Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. We are today focusing on Brent, your business, your life.
Yeah, so, you know, Richard and I were talking.
We can cut that out if we need to.
I don't care.
Okay.
It's pretty obvious in my videos. I was telling Austin. A bunch of changes have happened. I walked on a job site a month ago and Richard had like six guys there. I was like, where did these people come from? And so we talked about his business growing. And over the last 3 or 4 months, my business has changed dramatically. And so I wanted to catch everybody up on that. Essentially what happened is probably a year ago, maybe even longer than that, I had started, you know, the Lord was blessing our business. We were growing, but I didn't have any data. Okay. I didn't have anything to know. Well, how profitable are we? How good are we? What's going on? Should we grow the mill? I don't know. You know, how much money is the mill making? How much can we afford? You know, what if we went and bought a new business? How much would that cost? And just the financial data that I needed to grow the business, I didn't have. So I started looking for a person. I started asking friends and Hull got to the as big as it was going to grow with me at the helm. We did like 17 million, 16 million. We had, you know, 35, 40 employees.
Is that 17 million revenue?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the mill and homes?
And homes and design and okay. Architecture. And so I'm like, yeah, maybe we grow to a bigger business. You know, I don't know. Maybe we just did this. And very unsure of kind of what was going on. So I started asking some of my business friends and business people, and they made it very clear that to find a CFO for a business like mine is very difficult because accountants can tend to be about numbers. They want to read numbers, want to look at numbers, but to find someone that can actually take the accounting record and go, oh, we should make this decision is hard, especially with a small business, especially as business focused on construction. Literally, it started about a year and a half search for me to try to find help. We have a guy who helps us. He starts looking. He really isn't having much help. He's trying to find like young people because a buddy of mine, one of my best friends, the way they grew their business is they hired a young kid out of Ernst & Young, which is one of the big accounting firms, to come into their business. They hired him early and helped them manage the financials and build the business. So he goes, that's what you need. And so everybody he talked to like that over at the other thing, they didn't want to come to Fort Worth. They did, you know, they kind of looked at it a little bit as a backwater. They just, you know, the real activities over here, we're going to do. And so they just kind of like, no, not interested in that job.
11th largest city in the United States.
It's like a big prestigious school.
I suspect that those guys think they're a lot more important than they are, right? Mm-hmm. Just as all of us do, right? There's four major accounting firms, Ernst & Young, Accenture, which was old Anderson, KPMG.
Deloitte?
And then, Deloitte's one of them. Yeah, they're a consulting firm. And then there's one other one. They come from those worlds. And basically, they'll be accounting for a business that needs accounting help. And then the business really likes the guy and they'll hire him away. And a lot of those people that start out those accounting firms consulting for other businesses end up getting hired away. And so that's what he was trying to find me. And they weren't really interested in a, you know, $15, $20 million business in Fort Worth that might be able to grow. And so he ended up calling me one day and said, I got a guy, he's more than you want to spend, but you just need to talk to him. I was like, I don't know. And so this guy comes over, we end up sitting down and talking for about an hour and a half. Him explaining his background, me explaining my background, me explaining what the challenges are, him kind of saying, hey, I did that before. He was a turnaround guy. So his, you know, the last part of his career after he had grown up in that accounting firm, because he was with one of those KPMG, Kidder Peabody, whatever that thing is. He was then a controller, then a CFO. And so he had actually run these businesses. And the last 20 years of his career had been turnarounds, going in, helping companies fix things and then get it going. He said, the problem with turnarounds, you're only there for about 2 years, maybe 3 years at the most. You don't really establish roots. It's really hard because when you get there, no one likes you because everybody thinks you're going to fire them. He says just a lot of stress. He had the opportunity between our business and another turnaround. And I don't view our thing, and he doesn't either, that as a turnaround. It's just we needed help. And, he would say it was a growth opportunity. So I'm traveling. I'm doing a bunch of stuff. We have a good meeting. Call my headhunter, Kent. That guy's good. I like him. Yeah, we're going to talk again. I tasked Eric and said, hey, why don't you just look into some of the challenges and some of the problems that we've got with labor and everything else? He ends up sending me a week later, he sent me like a 20-page document, laying out my business. laying out the challenges, the opportunities,
took it as like 20 pages of problems.
It was 20 pages of his kind of analysis of what our business was and what it could be.
I was saying as he should, because it's like, that's kind of above and beyond. Like a lot above and beyond. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I did not expect that level of work. And so it was just like,
dang. Who did you say this was? This is the guy you hired?
This is the guy we ended up hiring.
Okay.
And so.
But at this point, it was perspective?
Oh, yeah. And I didn't think we were going to hire him. Literally 3 weeks, maybe a month later, we decided to meet out at the shop because I'm just going to, hey, well, you need to come look at the shop. It's interesting. I'm kind of interested in keep talking. I don't know where this will lead. He meets me out there. We talk. We're out there for 45 minutes or an hour, and then we go have coffee at not a drive-through Starbucks, actually a Starbucks where you could actually sit down. And we talk for another hour and a half, and just talking about stuff. And now we're like, okay, we kind of like each other. We kind of think that, as my daughter described it, our energy is are kind of similar. He's 62, I'm 60, right? So we're roughly the same age. Completely different experiences. And we're like, well, maybe we should look at this. And so then over about another month, we decide, he's going to come in and help the shop because that's really what his manufacturing is really a sweet spot. He's going to handle manufacturing, turn the shop around. Because I had, and I think I was expressed it on the show, we got to change from a job shop to a production shop. We can't can't keep being this, we'll do anything in wood. We've got to be focused. Our efforts to do that to this point had not worked. And so very quickly he would say things like, he's like, Brent, he goes, I've never been in a manufacturing environment where there wasn't a QC manager. I was like,
quality control manager.
And I'm like, okay. And he's like, we got to get a quality control manager. Basically the way the woodwork went through our shop is each of the craftsmen was kind of in control, but we had sent some stuff out to a job. And the weather stripping that came down from the top of the window in one case was about 2 inches down, in one case was about 1 inch down. The guys at the job said, we're not accepting that. This needs to be all the same. We're like, okay.
This is the brass weather stripping?
Yeah, the brass weather stripping. So it was little things like that a quality control person would have handled. And my shop manager at the time had said, I just can't get anybody to want to take on this role. That's one example of like 30 that he would bring out and point out, hey, why aren't you doing this? What's going on with this? Why don't you have this?
So this guy knows
manufacturing. Yeah, he knows manufacturing. He understands how it should work. And we hired him. He's there 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm just like, okay, I can give him more responsibility. He can actually help me with all this business. And anyway, so we have now hired this guy. We've hired this guy and he is helping a great deal. And it is a exciting time for us because it feels like God's blessing our business. We got all this opportunity. And finally, there is someone in place who can help me make decisions and do stuff that I never had before. So for instance, he brings in a consultant, this guy named Scott, and he says, Scott's going to help us build a plan to see how we can grow. And Scott comes in, he goes, oh my gosh, you guys are the typical VI. I'm like, what's the VI? And he goes, that book, business book, Traction, which would be another good book for you to read. There's a whole series, a whole business series that's come out on traction. And this is one of them. It's called Rocket Fuel. He goes, the Rocket Fuel idea is that there's a visionary and there's an integrator. And a visionary is the guy who sees the plan, what it can be. The integrator makes it happen. The integrator puts the processes in place so that you can grow.
Yeah, you're the visionary.
Yeah, his reason is called Rocket Fuel because one of their clients said, oh my gosh, if we can get this working, it's going to be like Rocket Fuel here. And that's why I'm excited and kind of like, oh my gosh, this is like about to go crazy here.
You were on propane before.
We were on whale oil before. We were not on anything.
Might have been combustible. On olive oil.
whatever the lowest oil is, we were on that. It's just really exciting time that we now look at these business opportunities completely different. Like you were talking about, we were talking about your work and kind of how much Hull's doing. We are looking at going into building 5 to 10 new houses a year through this That's program that we're talking
super
about doing.
Exciting.
That are in a very high end. The houses will be $4 to $10 million houses.
Dallas area, Fort Worth, or
both. Yeah. And so it's got an investor that's interested, and it just seems like that door never opened before because the Brent way of going through that would be, yeah, let's figure it out. Okay, his way of going, no. Here's the financing. Okay, here's the program of how these lay out. Here's when this gets built. This is how we're going to pay back investors. This is what this is going to be. We're going to need this person to do this. We're going to need this. And he sees all of those steps. I see what can be, but I have no idea how to get there. And
what about?
It's exciting.
Are there spec homes?
I don't think anybody wants to have that much risk on the table.
I was going to say, you at one point said, I'm never doing a spec home again. I think after your first spec home.
I've done probably 4 or 5 speculative properties in my career.
Well, one was right in the 2007-08 range.
Yeah.
I think one was.
Yeah. Yeah. I barely got out of that one. Yeah. Yeah. By the grace of God.
Yeah.
Got out of that one. So, yeah, I mean, it scares me, right?
Yeah.
But the Brent that it scares is not the Brent who understands the financials to make it happen.
Yeah.
That was propane Brent.
I think olive oil,
rocket fuel Brent is different.
Propane Brent. So
shows
funny.
Up with a propane tank.
Let's go.
On site.
Let's go. Let's put this rocket in the air.
Can't get it to lift off for some reason.
We're propane stuck. Tank and an it's office chair.
It's a little bit. It's a little it's bit like, yeah. like that. I mean, we're joking, but that's the image of me trying to grow this business without having this experience to know how to make that work.
Like, why can't I move?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because that. It's funny to hear you say this because I think a lot of people would go, what? Your company?
I know.
Speak to that.
Well, I mean,
to continue the analogy, I guess, before you,
yeah,
just to let you gather your thoughts.
30 years on propane, like how, you know?
Well, you know, a lot of motorhomes go on propane.
Here's the deal. I think that Alice and I would kind of joke about this because when new people come in, they expected to see a much different business than the business that they saw. Part of that visionary personality is I didn't know what I didn't know. And so I was surrounding myself with people that could help me put things together. For instance, Brittany, who does our brand managing, she's very good, okay? And she knows me well enough to know where my strengths are and makes us look better than we really are, right? Which is what all marketing should do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's she was creating an image of what we would do, and they would get here and it'd be a little bit chaotic. Like, well, who's going to, well, let's figure it out. And there was no processes. And so, you know, part of this search in my part to try to grow the business, to have data so we could make decisions. We were having meetings, like I hired Eric in September? I probably hired him in May. Okay. So he's been here 3 or 4 months. That year, we went to a planning meeting in January and said, this is going to be the year of process. So I knew that I needed processes in my business. I didn't know how to do them. I didn't know how to integrate them. And I didn't know how to put them together. And so, you know, one of the problems on our jobs has been in the past is that the work we do is beautiful, if not perfect, okay? The process of getting the client there was painful. Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, gosh, we got to figure out this process. So Well, Eric comes in. He goes, when are your health checks? I'm like, what's a health check? He goes, when are you going back talking to the homeowner and you know, making sure everything's okay? Oh, that's a good idea. We ought to do that. You know, it's just like these processes that make the whole thing work. There's another builder in town who's a successful builder, but I think he's a successful builder because his processes are really good. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know much about building, but he's a good process. And it's hard for me to admit as a design guy that someone can build a better house than me in that they would have a happier customer because that process was smooth. Whereas I would look at it and go, that's an ugly house. I don't want to build that house. I need to fix these five things. Well, in doing that without communicating whatever I was doing, I was frustrating them to the point where there was costing more, taking longer, but the end product would have been twice as good as this other thing, but the process sucked. And that's a real hard thing for me to not only admit, but to understand about myself so I can begin to fix it.
It's funny because that's a lot of what they say about like Michelangelo and Da Vinci and like all these guys. You hear the stories about how they're yelling at their patrons and like trying to, you know, I'm not saying you're yelling at your clients, but essentially that's kind of what that kind of
frustrates the clients. Yeah.
Well, but the visionary person has the end goal in mind and isn't like, hey, let me walk you through this process. They're like, I can create something awesome if you just let me. And so you have a lot of patrons who look at you and go, I know what I'm going to get is a beautiful house at the end of this. It may be hard, but I want the beautiful house, because I'm sure there's a lot of people listening right now who are like, yeah, I'd pay for the beautiful house. If I could get that, I would go through a couple of frustrations. And then there's some people who are listening, who are going, if it's going to be hard to work with, I want a less beautiful house, you know? And so there's a little bit of that too, where, you know, if it is easy to work with, and you get the better house, obviously you're going to pick the better house. So a lot of people are, I think,
well, and that's one reason why I'm excited, because when if he can come in and fix our processes, like, he's going to take over the project management job. We've got four project managers now on the home side, two on the mill side. He's going to take all six and put them through the same program. And any new project managers, we're trying to hire two more right now, will be part of that PMO office, project manager office, that will have all these systems in place. So this is how we do things. This is how we budget. This is how we schedule. This is how we communicate. And I'm just, that to me is just like, oh, thank the Lord. I mean, that would be such a huge relief for me to not have to solve that and be able to, you know,
focus on the vision.
Yeah. What they're saying is like, yeah, you, and I was saying this a little bit to you in that last episode, Richard, you need someone who recognizes what you're good at and says, yeah, you just keep doing that. I'm going to go fix all this. Mm-hmm. And so that's what that E-Myth is about, that book. It's about you don't want to do the books, or you don't want to do sales. I want to do this. Mm-hmm. And so you're finding people to help you manage that and figure that out.
I like doing the sales a lot, but I know you're just giving examples.
Right.
But yeah, I don't like doing the books and the invoicing and like that stuff.
And quite frankly, that is an easy position to hire for. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of bookkeeper kind of managers that could come into your business fairly inexpensively and probably not transform your business, but certainly make it run better and make you happier, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I said, look, if you paid a bookkeeper $40,000 a year and they took care of all this, would that be worth it? I think you would probably go, yeah. I mean, are you kidding me? The nights that I'm having to stay up doing payroll and doing all this other, I'm pulling my hair out, right? So
for sure.
Anyway, and there's part-time people that would do that too. So
yeah,
anyway.
And hearing you describe like your perspective, I feel like that. I feel like the visionary.
Yeah.
I don't feel like the integrator at all.
Right.
Like, I feel like I like to go meet people and, you know, chat and look at jobs and talk about what I know and in a way sell it without trying to sell it, just because I actually like this stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a quiz in that book, Rocket Fuel. I'd pull it up because it has like 10 questions if you're a visionary. And Christy and I were listening to it and we're just kind of laughing because it's just like so me 1,000%. I was like, oh yeah, I guess that is what I am. I guess that is what I am. It was crazy.
Yeah. It's ironic your project manager office's name, when the goal of a project manager is to not piss off the client.
The PMO, acronym.
Pissing me off.
Maybe we'll change that. Yeah. So.
Not an integrator, more of a visionary.
Anyway, it is.
When you get here, you can change it. So right away.
The first thing I'm going to do.
So that's just one, like that's kind of like the big thing. And then you look at what's happening with our design side. We've gone from.
What's happening with your design side?
We've gone from basically the lady who's running my thing, an old friend, great, Darla. She's awesome. I knew her 20 years ago when she worked for a preservation architect firm called Architexus. That's still in business. It's a great company.
Good name.
She worked for them. We knew each other, worked on some jobs together. She became available and we've hired her and she's now running our architect team. Those lift up videos I do on Instagram, that was about 2 years ago. Okay. And in year one of that whole thing, the way that business grew is we went from about 24,000 followers on Instagram to now over 100. But within about a 6 month period, it went from 24 to 90,000, just like that. And so we began to get calls for work consulting. And Alice, who's my handle of sales, she was at first, and she's really good at this. I wouldn't have done this because it's hard for me to say no to new ideas and new projects. But she finally started saying, we were, so that lift up video, and by the way, that was a lake house in Ohio that I'm actually going to go film in October. Kind of now, here we are almost 3 years later, 2.5 years later, filming the very first house that we had done on Instagram with this, cool. with this lake house thing. It's kind of fun.
Full circle moment.
Yeah, full circle deal. That led to all these calls on Instagram. Hey, can you help me? Can you help me? How does this work? Call info@brenthall.com. They talked to Alice. Alice was like, it's $250 an hour. It's $350 an hour. It's $500 an hour. It's 10-hour minimum, right? It's just like trying to just stop the flow of things. And I kept saying, covered up with work.
So I'm uncomfortable with it. I don't want it to be raised.
That went on for a year. And so the next year, I was like, I got to get some help. And so I hired an architect or two, and I had kind of part-time people. Then I hired Darla probably a year ago, September, October of last year. And since her one hire, we've now hired 8 architects. And we are trying to hire 2 more, right? It's exploded. And that design work has led to jobs literally all over the country, us designing new traditional homes. I mean, that farmhouse on Boone, that big influencer that does stuff, we're designing this traditional farmhouse for her. And that, I think, there's tons of opportunity. And what am I doing? I am basically taking the things I learned at North Bennett Street for how a house looked historically. And we basically said, okay, so you're wanting a kind of a late 1800s, early 1900s farmhouse. This is the way it would look. This is how it would be built. This is what the windows would look like. This is what the porch would look like. This is what your flooring would look like. This is what your trim would look like. And we've got like Chadsworth and Windsor and Kuchen and all these players that I've helping them build this traditional house. I think there is a lot of opportunity for that.
Sounds like it.
A lot of people who would say, I'm sick of the way new houses look, these white boxes that are ugly, that have no character. I want a house that has a story. I want a house that has a, you know, new house, old soul. And so we think there is a huge opportunity for us to do that. And so, but the things I'm preaching on YouTube and Instagram of traditional building methods, I mean, I don't know how many videos I'm looking at Austin I've done on fixing porches. I mean, dozens and dozens. And that it's just like people don't know how to build a freaking porch today. And so it's just like a little stupid thing that if I said, hey, Richard, you're going to make your career on porches, right? You're going to make your career on the columns and the beam and the entablature and how porches are put together.
I would actually love that.
It's crazy to me that would be such a key element that could make or break, you know.
Well, it's a big part of the
what
facade.
You do. It's a big part of the house. And yep. So, you know, it's you know, so there's the design side, talked about the building, the manufacturing side. Eric thinks we can grow the mill to be much bigger. Now that he's put the team in place, it's down there with the QC manager and everything else, we've gone back to looking at stuff that we used to build, stuff like this in this room, mm-hmm. that, you know, what I was doing was I was looking at it and saying, we got to stop making these other things. We only have to focus on windows and doors.
I remember you saying that. Yeah. We were both heartbroken.
We were pissed.
We were like, oh.
And he's now come in and I was like, we don't have to stop making those things. We don't have to stop doing that stuff.
We like Eric. we're big fans
of
him now.
He goes, that's crazy. If we can make revenue and stuff and doing that, he goes, we'll do it profitably. And all of a sudden, the prophecy
is fulfilled.
Deep.
The efficiency and profitability, right? And that's where the prophecy came. Those two things, if he's making those happen, I can build this cabinet here. I can build furniture.
Beautiful cabinet.
I can build all of this stuff now because he's now improved the, you know,
systems
and processes down at the shop. So now we're looking at building some cabinetry for some clients again. The client's happy. I'm excited.
Nice.
You know, we get Vossel
That's
involved.
So
Do you need a cabinet
that.
Guy?
We need all kinds of cabinet guys.
I know a cabinet guy. Kevin Jarvis. Bring on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. I heard that episode, too.
Yeah, he told him to stop building cabinets, build doors. He's my classmate in the Army.
I told him to build doors.
Yeah. Well, he said you should start building doors.
The reason I said that most likely is because cabinets are a dime a dozen, yeah. and you have to differentiate yourself like yeah. us. Like, we're not going to do production cabinets.
Yeah,
no.
We're going to do the furniture grade nice stuff that
you
people
should
want.
See his. That's what he does. It's pretty cool. So if you want to do it, I'll call him. Don't worry.
I don't know. I don't know if he like the other thing we were talking the other day about how many people if we went up to Boston and said you've got a job, how many would come to Fort Worth?
Yeah, that's a good question.
You know, it's just like you know there is a, yeah, there is know. A. I remember when I was leaving North Bennett Street, Portland, mm-hmm. like Portland, Oregon, that'd be cool.
Portland, Oregon or Maine?
No, Portland, Oregon. East Coast, staying in the East Coast, Connecticut, you know, the New England. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's okay. You can work in there. West Coast, maybe Portland, Washington, up in that thing. And I don't know whether maybe there was a Montana, but the idea of coming to Texas was yeah, a little bit. Yeah. It was like, conservative. I don't know whether it's a conservative Bible Belt, whatever it was, or whether it's just too dang hot. Whatever it is, there's a stigma.
I've seen the stigma being a lack of
craft.
Cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like people don't look at Texas and go, "Oh my gosh, they've got like really cool timber framed buildings." Like a lot of my classmates are timber framers, and a lot of them are, you know.
You know what one of my dreams is?
Yeah,
being a visionary.
Yeah,
you know what my dream is? That Fort Worth, Texas would be a hub for craftsmanship because of what you're doing, what I'm doing, that we would have.
I feel like we've put it on the map a little bit.
I feel like if we
for
could,
you for sure.
if we could make, like you have tech hubs, like Austin became a tech hub, that this became a craft hub here because of the cool things we're doing. That's like, I wonder if that could ever happen, is that we're changing the conversation about craft and beauty and building and stuff like that.
I think we already are kind of like in that process.
I just want to see it get picked up in like commercial jobs, where a commercial job is like, we want a traditionally built, you know, 1840s structure, like a high rise built like it would have been built in the 1840s. You know,
we're bidding a project right now, and this is a group that does this.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Catholic Church. We're building a building for them right now. And why did they come to us? Because they wanted a contractor who understood classicism. They wanted a contractor who understood traditional building methods.
So would you do like a timber framed chapel and everything?
It's stone. It'd be stone. Yeah, and so,
but timber frame roof have to be the traditional.
Yeah, I believe there is. They're in schematic design right now.
Cool.
It's being worked out, but yes, there would be some of that. And what they're saying is like, look, some of the areas need to be very high end, like you build your houses. Others of it, you're going to have vinyl base, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just going to be,
yeah,
you're going to be very, you know, utilitarian and commercial. And then other areas are going to be, we need nice doors, we need nice windows, we need
That's cool.
You know, and so they get that. You look at, you know, another person who's doing that is the guy at Harlan Crow over in Dallas. He's mm-hmm. doing the Parkland facility, mm-hmm. which is right on the tollway. It has the domed building and the classical yep. stuff. He's oh, doing that.
Is that, and that's a historic building?
Those are new buildings that look historic.
Every time I pass that, I'm like, that's so cool.
It is cool. And he's building at a multiple of 4 or 5 times what other developers are building at.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also created a campus that is unparalleled.
Yeah.
And so I think that's happening. Yeah. I think on the commercial side, you're seeing the value of doing that, just like Seaside and Rosemary Beach and those places did for new developments.
Yeah.
Like if we build it, they will come. And that's kind of what Eric and I are thinking about when we're talk about doing a speculative new house. We believe that if we build something beautiful that isn't, you know, cookie cutter McMansion-y, that it will separate itself from the rest of the, you know, cheaply built houses, and it's an opportunity.
It's also, there's that whole project that you were in talks about doing where all the spec homes. But then they fell through. But
well, so what we're thinking on that front, and that hasn't completely gone away, but it's basically the starter house, neighborhood where you would basically build around an ideal or a, you know, much like Seaside is built around this new urban concept. You would create an ideal and build all the houses in there that all communicate that same ideal. We had a design client that's north of us a little bit that wanted a whole house but couldn't afford us. Their budget was $1 million. And so they're like, well, how can we do this? And so one of the production builders we were talking to, we went back to him and said, hey, why don't we try this house? This will be our experiment to see if we can build a whole house on a budget. And what it is it's managing the framers, it's managing the drywall team, and we are breaking apart the parts and pieces of those costs and going, you're building right now at that production level, $130 a foot. We're at, you know, $800 a foot. You know, can we get it to this house at $300 a foot, $350 a foot? Can we do that? And so, you know, they want 100-year windows in their house, right? And so they're wanting some high-end products that are like, I'm not sure how that's going to affect the budget. And so, but that's a fun experiment. And if we can do that, I think there's a huge opportunity to build beautiful houses at that 300-foot level that we could never reach otherwise by choosing different subs and managing.
Then it becomes a 100-year house.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a lot of exciting things. I mean, I'd look at linseed paint, okay?
Yeah,
that
baby.
That I've talked about. And
I heard
and
you all talking about that.
Such a big fan.
I think this could be a game changer. I think this could be a kind of product that would blow up the whole Hardy market. Because if we start, you know, if you realize that the paint that we're putting on our products right now is plastic, and the reason things are rotting is because they can't breathe. You basically wrapped it in saran wrap.
And the house is molding.
And the house is molded and everything else. And if changing the paint solves 85% of it, 90% of that problem, all of a sudden I don't need Hardy to make something last long, right? I can actually paint with this linseed paint, which will allow the wood to dry out if it gets wet. And all of a sudden I can use wood siding. I don't need Hardy because I think a lot of customers look at, I've got to have Hardy in order for it to last long. And if we just change the paint, I mean, and so.
I hate also, that Hardy.
Linseed
I hate
paint,
that stuff.
As it fades, all you do to revitalize it is go get linseed oil and paint the house.
Yeah. And you basically can wipe the house with boiled linseed oil and it will revive it.
Or even non-boiled. It just takes longer to dry.
I had a piece of Hardy fall off the back of my house a couple of weeks ago, and it's like an egg, like it shattered. And I'm like, so now I have to pop all the underlying pieces off, get to that one. I could try to like shove it up there.
Sneak it up.
But I can't fix it. You know, I can't go and like cut it and like patch it. Like, well, could wood as good? I mean, I guess you can, but
I've just heard not only that, but I heard when it gets wet, if you stick it in a bucket, it just turns to mush.
It falls apart. Oh yeah, quick.
It falls pretty quick.
I saw some videos of that.
I noticed that. So you're just like, this is not a good product.
No, it's not. I noticed that.
Whenever
it's new, whenever it's newer, like you get it from the lumberyard, because I have bought a piece of it before to repair my house. Versus when it's old, the older one is it feels so porous and
it chips really bad. It's just
if you shoot it wrong, it just obliterates. Yeah, it's like
if you shoot it.
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about the nail gun.
Yeah, I shoot it and install it. Our neighborhood's not that bad. Actually, maybe it is kind of.
Anyway, so there's the update. We're 3-4 months in on this new experiment, and as you might be able to tell, I'm very not even cautiously optimistic anymore. I'm optimistic that there's enough cool things going on I don't know what's going to happen, how we're going to grow, but we are in growth mode for sure.
Cool.
Nice. That's awesome. That $1 million house that you were just talking about, do you think that's what would your part in that be? Just like the design side?
Be design. Like we're working separately with the client in design. And then we are working closely with the builder. He's a good friend. And we think that there's opportunities we could continue to work together. And so we're working with him trying to establish a budget. Where do you spend money? Where don't you spend money?
Right.
We're even looking at the 100-year window and saying, okay, well, if we had a 100-year window light, where we're not doing
75-year one.
What doing?
Oh, yeah, it could be Domino like mine. You know, I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, the preservationist in me goes, but maybe
it'll fall apart.
It might be something like that.
I don't trust Domino's.
I'll let you know how mine holds.
Yeah,
up.
Yeah, I want to know.
But we're looking at it not necessarily with changing the joinery, because joinery isn't expensive. Okay,
right.
It might be expensive for you when coming up with that joinery in the corner that's historic would require all these different cutters and everything else. We're already set up for that.
Right.
So we don't necessarily, that isn't changing costs a lot. And so, but going from Sapele to Red Grandis, okay, that saves money. If we go-
Pine. Old windows were made out of pine. They also had lead paint, so I guess that's a factor.
Well, it's old growth wood. It could be that linseed paint, allows your window to dry. I don't think I could trust it for a 100-year product.
Yeah.
Another thing I notice a lot of new houses is it's a lot of fixed windows.
That's what I was going to say. Instead of going with a double hung where most people don't even open the upper window, you do a single hung. That right there saves a lot of money.
Casements,
absolutely. If we change the hardware on our windows, because right now the pulleys that we use for our weights and pulleys, those things up in the corner, our cost is $25 each. So you got $100 just in pulleys that if we went with a cheaper pulley, all of a sudden it were a cheaper pulley. What does that cost? I don't know. And so
how much is the brass?
Brass chain?
The weather stripping, because you could do TFS or Kulon or something like that. I'm sure you wouldn't want
to
do that.
I asked you to get me a sample of that.
I didn't.
Yeah, you did not do that.
And we have so many offcuts of it.
He was doing a restoration job up in Boston, and he kept describing this weather stripping. I was like, I really need to see that. I'm not really sure what that is.
Well, I quoted a job for this builder, two houses for the same builder. I think the houses were like $3 million, and my trim on one came in at $70 or $80, and the other one came in at like $60. And they said, that's too much. Yeah, and I was like, dang, you're doing a $3 million. I didn't say this. It was just like in my mind, like $3 million, you're not. And it had paneling and like, it was.
Yeah, I mean, the wood trim package in this house will be in that range.
Mm-hmm. 70 to 80.
Yeah.
$1,000, not.
Yeah, 80,000.
Yeah.
$80.
Cheap 80.
Yeah, so I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like you're talking about a $3 million house that couldn't afford a $70,000 trim budget, and I'm talking about a $1 million house where that trim budget actually can be very important, like our windows and how much money can we save in other areas? So anyway, yeah, it's I mean, we're also just as builders, I'm interested in learning what this guy's framers are going to charge versus ours. And so,
well, let me tell you this. So that same builder, I trimmed technically three of his houses and the framing was awful, like awful. And I was like, the homeowner would walk through and he would have, he got to the point where he had bought a laser, he bought a square, he bought a level. And this is not a DIY guy. This guy is like the CEO of some like thing. And like, he was over there on the wall, like rocking the level. He had the square at the corner. And so basically what we had to do, like imagine a wall that's framed. Here's your 90. These walls were like in. So whenever we wrap our base around it, we just follow the wall. So like if that's like a 45 typically for the, or a 90, and then we're cutting 45s when it comes in like this, we're going to like 47, 48. So then he's seeing that on the floor because the floor is running straight and then the corner is like that. And there's multiple places where this happened where he's like, you're going to have to change this. And I'm like, I understand. You know, so we basically put it back to 90. Now there's like a 3/4 inch gap and the guys come back to float it with drywall. This happened everywhere on all of these guys' houses.
I believe that. And it's just, most people don't understand that the reason we're more expensive is because our walls don't do that.
And I was about to say, at the ranch down there, it's like literal perfection.
Yeah.
Even the guy, the new hire that I have, he's been doing carpentry for like 20 years. He's from Maine and he knows a little bit about like the old school way of doing stuff. And he told me, Richard, I got to say, this house is framed on point. He's like, tell the framer, like, good job.
That's cool.
So I told that to Ryan.
It's funny. That's one of the first things we learned in North Bennett was how to frame a house. And they were really persnickety about our framing. Like Steve was like, all right, that's out by about a degree. So redo it.
Well, it matters.
We took so many walls down.
Just realize that our framer, it works by the hour. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we establish a budget, but then he's hourly. So our framing budget is probably twice what a guy like that other one gets because he's got Hispanic crews and he's probably paying them a set fee of $2 a square foot or whatever he's paying them. And, you know, they're working to that and they're trying to get out of there as fast as they can. And so that's a different mindset between, hey, we got a problem here. I got to float this up. I got to fix this. Instead of just running everything across it and let someone else worry about it, they fix it. Mm-hmm. And so you're just like, it just takes more time.
It's exponential. Your wall's off. His drywall's off. Now you want me to come put paneling on that?
Yeah.
Now you're paying me to sit there and just bust out drywall, plain freaking crown boards down.
Seriously,
twisted boards down, and you think you're saving money.
Yeah.
And that same house, I think when I was done, like, with what we had to do, I came back for probably, like, another $20,000 in repairs. So just off us.
Yeah.
So, like, we're there charging hourly. You need to come fix this. Oh, this and this. I'm like, you know,
I know.
It's unfortunate. And we try to address some of that as we get into, like, as we're
going there.
Like, yeah, it's not like we just slap stuff up, but there's only so much you can do. And they're already kind of on you, like, trying to save money.
Right.
So I'm just hearing this $1 million house that's going to be, like, spectacular. And I'm a little skeptical, unfortunately.
Well, but, I mean, I am too. I mean, you know, I don't know whether we can do it, right? Mm-hmm. And so we are, that's kind of the fun too of it.
Like, yeah, the unknown.
Can we do this, right? Can we really build a house for that price? And, you know, where are we going to be in trouble? And where are we going to have to cut corners and try to figure this out? So
I want to offer some, like, in 2 cents on that. It's like one of the things. If I know, like, as the finished carpenter of a house, if I know exactly what I'm doing, I could probably get it done so fast.
Well, that, you know? And that's the other piece of it, is that we are spending a lot of time on design. Mm-hmm. And part of their budget, you know, is design. And we're telling people when we're doing design that it's 10% of construction costs. So it's close to $100,000 for their plans, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas $1 million house might have $30,000 that they spend on the plans, $20,000, maybe even less. And so we are spending exponentially more there for exactly that reason, so that we can give the framer, this is exactly what you're framing. Don't do anything else. Yes. Don't do more. Don't do less.
Yeah.
And to you, this is how many feet of trim as you're doing. This is exactly the detail, as opposed to, well, we'll figure it out when we get there, yeah. Right? And just, and that happens all the time.
Well,
because no interior elevations are typically ever drawn for a house like that.
Yes, and I will say, I'm not against working like that. Like we're, like some of the designers are like, here's this sketch.
Right.
Here's this Pinterest photo. And I'm not against that. I'm not like knocking it. But I'm saying, like, to accomplish that goal of getting this $1 million house, like, on a tight budget, that's not going to work.
Well, and we've had deals, and a lot of designers can't draw. And so we've had literally PowerPoint presentations of Pinterest photos of inspiration. Oh, we're thinking like this. And then you go, okay, you want me to build this? No, not exactly. And you're like, okay, well, what the hell am I building, right? What am I doing? And so, well, we kind of like this. We like this. To your point.
Yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
just like, and how do you bid that?
And well, you want to be nice about it. And you're just like, okay, well, let's work through it. But realize that this conversation you're paying for.
Yeah, yeah. 100%.
I'm standing here on the site, like, I could be doing something else. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have even like time lapses of me like with the, like trying to figure out with the tape measure on the wall and like looking at the thing, and I get it, right? Like the picture, but it takes forever. Versus if you say that's a 4-inch board, it's a 6-inch board.
Just, yeah.
You know.
100%.
But it's, yeah.
Or these are the moldings and this is where they go. And this, you know, you're not having to go mill anything. You're having to do anything. It's just go put that up.
All those books that we admire, like those books we've had out on the past episodes, are telling the guy exactly what to do.
And like, to the point, even carving too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Even the ornamentation.
That's a good point.
So I'd actually love to be a part of that. Like if I can submit a quote on that, like
for sure.
It'd be cool.
Yeah, for sure. We'll keep you tuned. All right. So that's the update.
Well, thanks for the update, Brent. Thanks for watching.
I actually have one more update that we'll do in the Patreon section.
All right. So
let me do something real quick. Just kidding. The Pella. Pella windows and doors. Hardy board. Yeah. Hardy
board. So just as a reminder, if you are a patron at patreon.com/passionforcraft, you get an extra 10 minutes on the episodes. And so we're just going to share a little bit more.
Yeah, the extra 10 minutes is not me and Jackson stripping either.
Thankfully.
Yeah, my goodness. It'd be 30. No, so thank you guys again. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.